Hey there, I'm so pumped to tell you about an amazing new community I've launched called Grief to Growth Circle Community. It's a space for people who are grieving to come together to support each other and for people who want to know who we are, why we're here, and where we're going to have those conversations, all the things we talk about on the podcast. So I invite you to join me at grieftogrowth.com/community to become part of this compassionate crew. The best part is 100% free. And you have access to me in addition to everybody else in the community. In fact, the podcast will be there so you can talk about the things we talk about in the podcast right there in the community. There's also some premium content if you want to go deeper in the work I'm doing, but mostly it's about building relationships and community and about sharing resources and supporting each other. So come on over and check it out. It's grieftogrowth.com/community. I'll see you inside. Hey, everybody, this is Brian back with another episode of Grief to Growth. And this is a podcast where we adventure in the profound journey of growth, of understanding and hope that often emerges from the deepest grief. So if you're joining us for the first time, I want to give you a heartfelt welcome. We delve into the intricacies of the human experience. We explore life, death, and the many facets of grief that touch us all. Our conversations aim to enlighten, to inspire, and to provide solace by sharing stories of resilience and of transformation. And today's episode, we're honored to host Deborah Kasdan. She's the author of the book, Roll Back the World, A Sister's Memoir. Her narrative is not just a memoir. It's a powerful exploration into the heart of a family that was grappling with the seismic effects of mental illness. Today, we're going to dive deep into some of the most pressing issues surrounding mental health today. We'll explore the state of mental health options in the U.S. We'll discuss the scarcity of resources and the critical need for comprehensive care. We'll get Deborah's insight into navigating the complex world of long-term care for family members. And we're going to shine a light on the often overlooked aspects of mental illness, the relentless and loving care provided by families. We'll also talk about the societal stigma around mental health issues. Her story is a testament to the urgent need for conversation and for change, pushing against the misconceptions and prejudices that so many of us face. Her journey through her experience with her sister is one I think is going to enlighten us all. So whether you're here seeking comfort, understanding, or knowledge, join us as we unfold these vital topics with Deborah Kasdan. So let's continue to grow together and welcome Deborah to Grief to Growth.
Hello, Brian. Glad to be here.
Yeah, it's really good to have you here, Deborah. I know that you wrote this book about the journey that you and your family went through with your sister. So tell me about your sister, Rachel.
Rachel is 3.5 years older than me, and she was a very creative, adventurous girl. She loved to explore, and she was, in a way, my role model. She told me things I needed to know. When I started kindergarten, you can't just talk, you have to raise your hand. What colors went together and when I got dressed. Mainly though, she what books to read. Mm-hmm. And it was in books and literature and writing that I think we kind of had a lot in common. She loved reading. I did too. But she became, in high school, a poet. She loved Walt Whitman, and many of her poems are nature poems like his. And when we were in high school, well, she was three. Yeah, she was finishing high school. I was just starting. Mm-hmm. She would be writing late at night. I'd hear the typewriter going in our room. She was quite a presence in my life.
Yeah, I can imagine sisters. So how many total children in your family?
We were four.
Okay.
Rachel, then 3.5 years later, myself, then a brother, barely 2 years younger than me, and then a younger sister, 7 years younger than me.
Okay. And I know your book is about your sister and your families, because I want to add your family, because these journeys that we go through, we're all together, we're all intertwined. So tell me about the beginning of her diagnosis. When did that happen?
After she finished high school. In high school, she was a little bit troubled. She had trouble focusing on her schoolwork, and she was more interested in doing her own thing. after she didn't want to go to college right away. And this was a high school where most of the kids went to college. Mm-hmm. So she decided to go to Israel and work on a kibbutz. And she joined up with a group and she loved working on the kibbutz. And she was just a natural because much as she loved to read and write, she loved physical activity, labor. And we got very detailed letters about her activities and adventures in Israel. And she came home and she looked just great. She was bronzed and beautiful and just wonderful looking and very worldly and cosmopolitan. But then she began traveling in the States to New York. We were in St. Louis then, in the middle of the country. And she would go off to New York, live on the Lower East Side. And then she decided she wanted to live in San Francisco. And she was kind of bouncing around and she kind of lost her way. And she was going with a friend to Montreal, and the friend called up my parents and said that something was wrong. Come get her. They put her on a plane. My parents picked her up. When she was in San Francisco, the lawyer she worked for, she was a legal secretary, said something's wrong. Come get her. So apparently she was having some type of psychotic breaks, and my parents committed her to a hospital. I mean, there were attempts to have treatment with, you know, private psychiatrists, and
sure,
they recommend institutionalization. So she was 23. That was in 1965. We're going back a bit, but she was 23 when she was first institutionalized.
Okay. And up until that point, had you noticed anything about her mental health or her mental state?
She was angry a lot. She had especially, well, to both my parents, but especially to my mother. And I attribute that to some past history from very early years. So she just seemed very angry and intent on doing her own thing, kind of oppositional, as I call it now. But I first noticed something but I thought my parents just wanted her to, you know, lead a more conventional life. Not that they were all that conventional, but, you know, when she didn't want to go to college full time, they said, okay, but then you should have a job. But then she couldn't keep her jobs. But I first noticed something when she came back from San Francisco and she told me that two men had followed her from New York City to San Francisco. She had seen two men. And I could just see the fear in her eyes. And I knew she was in the grip of something, you know, beyond just normal rebellious behavior.
Right. And she was diagnosed as schizophrenic. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. It's kind of a catch-all diagnosis. I mean, it overlaps now with a lot of overlap with bipolar disorder now, then there's schizoaffective disorder.
Mm-hmm.
But she checked all the boxes for schizophrenia here.
Okay. And you said your parents tried to get her private treatment at first with psychiatrists, I guess, psychologists. How did that go? And at what point did your parents or someone make a decision she had to be hospitalized?
Yeah. I think she knew how to game the system with the private doctors, and she knew what to say. She's very, very, very bright. So she never would continue very long with them. When she was hospitalized, I was away at summer camp working as a counselor, a residential camp. So this was after my after my first year of college. And I didn't see exactly what happened. And that's one of the issues that's always bothered me, that I never really understood exactly why my parents hospitalized her to begin with. And because it's very traumatic to be involuntarily hospitalized,
Yeah,
and
of course, yeah.
it can cause a lot of damage on its own. And I think that's what happened to Rachel. I think they saw a lot of self-destructive behavior. She had been living at home, and she might have run off. She might have run off and gotten herself into trouble. My father would sometimes have to pick her up. She would kind of hang out in the streets for a while. So I'm not sure exactly what triggered it at that particular time, but it was very upsetting, very shocking to me. And my parents told me that, oh, they have new medication now. They'll give her the medication and she'll get better. But I think the initial medication she had, they gave big doses in those days, and they weren't quite as good as they weren't as good as the medication we have now, which also has bad side effects. But these really, really knocked her out. She was sedated, basically. They call it chemical handcuffs. And she it was very difficult then when I did see her in the hospital. So it was the beginning of deinstitutionalization. When they were closing up, when they decided people shouldn't be staying in hospitals for a long term. And she was she was discharged to very dangerous parts of St. Louis, and was harmed there. She said she was assaulted, raped, in boarding houses there. And my parents were just beside themselves and wanted to get her readmitted. And there were in the hospital discharged her several times to these very inappropriate and unsafe conditions. And that began a the so-called revolving door of discharge and readmission, discharge, readmission. So that was a pattern for quite a number of years.
So what was your experience in terms of the way mental illness was accepted or not accepted during that time?
It was very, it, yeah, it was stig, there was stigma, just, and there still is stigma. There's something, especially schizophrenia, I think, when you have that diagnosis, it has all kinds of associations. I mean, my parents were very educated. My father was a social worker, not a clinical social worker, but he did community work. So they were aware of, they were pretty sophisticated in their thinking, but it's still embarrassing, and there's shame, and especially for my mom, because even they would blame it on the mother. And my mother was very defensive with with a hospital social worker and didn't want to get involved, felt very strongly that she was being blamed. I was never part of the sessions with the hospital because I was away at school. And that's one of the issues that I bring up in my book, is that it's so important for families to have support early on. And that everybody knows what's happening. But I didn't feel comfortable talking about it. And I think, I think that I just felt shame that I couldn't do anything for her, and that my family couldn't do anything for her. We couldn't afford a private hospital that would have, involved selling the house, or just all it's just impractical for middle class families, and to be in a state hospital like she was in, it's just there's a stigma mass media had people like Sybil, multiple personality disorders. Lots of people think schizophrenia is multiple personality disorder. It's right. Not. That's a very narrow diagnosis. Mm-hmm. So it was very, very difficult to talk about. And I think largely because of my own sense of shame and hopelessness. And I didn't know, you know, as time went on, it became less and less clear that she could really recover from this. I mean, that initial hope goes away pretty fast. So, I think what was most damaging is that it was so difficult to talk about in the family itself. I think everybody had their own response to it. So you're talking about six people, right, with their own lives and their own needs and their own issues. And I think not being able to talk about it in the family was very non-productive, yeah, in the long run.
So within the family, how would you approach it at all? Or did you approach it at all?
Well, everybody was different, but, you know, I asked my parents and they gave me the answer that they heard from the psychiatrist. I said, but I don't understand that. They told me as much as they could. Mm-hmm. And my mother shared, it was easiest to talk to my mother, but I believe that they were doing the best that they could and they were doing all that they could. My brother thought they were, it was outrageous to institutionalize her. He identified with her more strongly. He felt more rebellious than I did and had his own issues that he was dealing with, mm-hmm, that involved some shame on his part. And he never got to talk about his issues till much later. He pretty much distanced himself from the family right after. Now, my brother and I were both, in those early years, we had just started college. I went off to Michigan. He went off to Seattle. So we were spread out pretty far. And then my little sister stayed home, but she was, you know, she was 13 years old when this started. So she had all issues of adolescence. Mm-hmm. And so everybody was, you know, all the things that you try to deal with kids individually got, you know, they kind of brushed aside. In fact, you know, my mother said it towards the end of the life, she said, I just regret that all the focus was on Rachel. And I didn't understand her at first, because I thought we didn't do enough for her. Mm-hmm. But she, I think, you know, in reflection, I've reframed it in mind that she meant that she didn't get to deal with us as much as, you know, as much as she would have liked to individually for our own individual development. Yeah.
Yeah. So was Rachel, I know she was in and out of the hospital. Did she have better times or what was the experience like when she would come out?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey there, something I want to tell you about today. My podcast platform, Buzzsprout, has recently made it easier for me to allow you to support me financially. Go to www.grieftogrowth.com/subscribe. That's grief2growth.com/subscribe. And once you're there, you can sign up to support me financially. Now, you can do it for as little as $3 a month or, of course, as much as you'd like. If you do that, you'll get access to bonus episodes, and you'll see those in the regular feed. They'll have a lock on them. But when you become a subscriber, you'll actually get access to your own private feed, and you'll be able to listen to the regular podcast along with the bonus podcast for the subscribers. I want to thank you for listening. I want to thank you for sharing the podcast. And I want to thank those of you who support me financially. Have a great day, and on to the episode.
Yeah, the thing about mental illness and with psychosis-related illnesses, the psychosis is the psychoses are episodic themselves. And she would get kind of manic and, you know, just dash off somewhere and do right. something.
Right.
But then I think if they're not overly medicated, you know, there can be, you know, you can function, and then they can learn how to deal with the psychotic episodes or mm-hmm. avoid them. So when she was well, you know, she could visit and talk and, you know, have interesting conversations. She read, they tried some, for her low level jobs, you know, like babysitting. I shouldn't say low level, but I mean that they were, below her educational level. Mm-hmm. And I think she could do that for a little while, but then, you know, she got bored because she wanted to be a poet. She wanted to be a writer, and she was writing poetry, and that's what she wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. So what?
But I think the over medication just suppressed what would have been the high points in her development.
Yeah, it's recovery.
Yeah,
it's a tough line to because to keep people from getting too high, they medicate them, but then they're not functioning. They're cutting off their personality, their creativity. I think a lot of people feel like when they're having those that medication, so they rebel against it.
Yeah. So there are people now who are working to recover without depending so much on medication, and they don't even use the phrase schizophrenia. They use the word hearing voices, and they work on ways to avoid the voices when they can, but to live with them when they need to, and not make medication the centerpiece of their recovery.
Mm-hmm. So how do you feel things have improved since that diagnosis, if at all?
There is some better medication, but everybody cannot tolerate it. It has, especially for the psychosis, it can have very severe side effects, life-threatening side effects. So people who use it have to be tested all the time, regularly.
Mm-hmm.
If they don't have, you know, their blood work will show if they're going to have a reaction to it. There are ways to recover that involve outpatient treatment and supportive housing, because housing is one of the biggest needs for people who have trouble keeping a job or a well-paying job. And that's what Rachel ultimately found. It took a long time, but she found an agency, a local agency that could provide that for her.
Mm-hmm.
So there are models of recovery that have, you know, that may or may not have medication. I think most of them have some medication, but without these other things, the medication won't really be enough. So the trouble, of course, now is the lack of consistent funding and robust funding. So you get into a cycle that short-staffed, they're not effective, and then people say, well, you know, they're not working. Well, they're not working because they don't have effective robust funding from the community. It involves community funding, state funding, federal grants.
Mm-hmm.
It can be done. Yeah.
So what do you wish people knew about mental health issues? What do you wish society would understand that we don't understand?
Well, that people can recover even from severe mental illness. If it's done right, there is recovery is possible. That families need to be involved early on because they can be a wonderful source of support if families are able to stay intact and understand, know what to expect and deal with their own issues. As you know, every family is going to have its own issues. Every individual does. Then they can be a support. But sometimes when you have a person who's very oppositional, they may not want to be with their family. Then the community needs to provide this support. Mm-hmm. And that sometimes when you see people who are obviously seriously mentally ill on the streets or the parks, wherever, I wish people could understand that they have families who love them, but may not have been able to help them and may or may not be estranged. But it's not always because they were rejected. It's because the families didn't have the support or the circumstances were such that they couldn't support them. So that people of all, with severe mental illness are, they have their histories. They have their capabilities. They have their problems, but they're full people who come from families and communities.
Mm-hmm. So with your family, you mentioned, the stigma, I think, but also was there any we should be able to, she should be able to live with us, or was there guilt in having to institutionalize her?
Yeah.
How did that go?
Oh, definitely. Severe guilt. My brother was very angry at my parents, and that led to some temporary estrangement on his part. I respected my parents' decision, but yet I couldn't, I just couldn't talk to them about my feelings. And I just had this feeling of hopelessness and helplessness. Being helpless is a terrible feeling. For some years, as it turned out, throughout her life, I think the one thing my sister wanted from me was to send her books until her last years, when she, it was hard for her to read, but I had to pick up books and send them to her wherever she was staying, because she moved around a lot, even in hospitals, and some cash for cigarettes. That was the extent of the help I could give her. I thought a lot about why can't she live with us? But I knew I couldn't raise my own children and have my own career if she was living with us. I just had this fear that, she would take off and I'd have to go find her. So I was almost haunted by this fear. And she couldn't live with my mother. There was too much tension and anger between them.
Mm-hmm.
She would ask sometimes, and then I'd feel guilty that I couldn't have her in my family,
right,
household. And then she would say, then she would change her mind. She said, "No, I don't want to live with my sister." She didn't. I think the ideal situation would have been to find her someplace near a family, near my parents at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Again, if there was supportive housing that was effective, then a family can be involved. Even if they can't live with them, they can be involved with their with their life, somewhat involved in the decisions, so they can't make all the decisions.
Right.
But to keep the connection, I think that's what's so important. Because when estrangement sets in, then you lose the connections. There were periods where I didn't know where my sister was. I couldn't even write. Not long periods, but we're talking about 30 plus year span. So conditions were taken over different times.
Right.
So, and she moved to different hospitals for various reasons. And then when she would get out, she could be, there were times when she was living on the streets and I didn't know where she was until she got readmitted.
During that time, was she making her own decisions, or did someone have power of attorney for her?
My parents remained official guardians. And my father did. And then when he died, my mother did. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean you get to make decisions. That's just some legal construct. She would get her SSI checks directly sent to the hospital where she was at. So when I think they were involved in the decisions while she was in St. Louis, in St. Louis State Hospital for 15 years. But then there was the big change when my brother took her out west, and then everything changed.
So your brother did take her out west for a period of time.
Yes, he decided. So this was 15 years into this. He was freshly divorced. He decided that he could get her help she needed, and he was going back to Seattle. He had moved away, but he was going back. Mm-hmm. And he could get her the help he needed, and he lined up. We had lots of meetings about it, family meetings about it. It was a big decision. We didn't do it lightly. And I felt, I didn't know whether what he proposed was possible. We spent a lot of time talking about it, mm-hmm. Involved my younger sister, and he just didn't see any hope for her in St. Louis. He didn't agree with my parents' decision. They had a lawsuit going against the state hospital. It was in federal court. And he thought that would just keep her in the hospital rather than help her get out. Mm-hmm. So I supported, and my little sister supported the decision to take her out to the Pacific Northwest, to Seattle. And he had doctors lined up and consultations, and it lasted 3 months. Mm-hmm. And then she was on her own. She took off.
Okay. Yeah.
And she got into the Oregon State Hospital system.
Okay. So when she would take off like that, how would she end up in another hospital? Would it be through the police, or how did that happen?
I think when she left my brother, I think it was voluntary. She had been in a day treatment program, and I think it was, he had been trying to get her into that. It was voluntary. So all of the above. Sometimes it was police. When she got into the Oregon state system, it was the police. I think she set a little fire or something. It's a way to attract attention to get help.
Yeah.
And that was the police. Then she was discharged. And when the placements didn't work and the halfway homes, it might be voluntary. It might be involuntary. Mm-hmm. Sometimes if she didn't have a place to stay, she would just knock on the door, so to speak, of the hospital and ask for readmission. Right. Because she was so damaged. I mean, you know, after all those years, you know, the whole system infantilizes somebody. They didn't want to keep her for many years. They were incentivized. The incentive for them was to move her into a transitional housing, but it never worked for her. And so then, eventually she was in a chronic ward. And that's when she finally met up with somebody who was able to get what she needed, she needed.
Yeah. So it sounds like over the years, maybe things have gotten a little bit better. What would you like to see in our mental health system? If you had a magic wand, you could wave it.
Well, something like that, what finally worked for her. Local agencies who have roots in the community, ideally near family. That didn't happen for Rachel, but that could have. That's the ideal system. Not that the family controls adults with serious mental illness, but they might have some input and say, and so local agencies that are funded by local communities and the state, philanthropic funding, as well as government funding. That Fountain House is a model for that. That's a national organization where they provide recovery, where they have therapy, occupational therapy, socializing. People need a purpose. They need coaching to go back to school, or job coaching is a big, is very important. How to keep a job. And it, you know, it takes a lot of staff to help people get back in the community after they've been in the hospital. As well as talk therapy, therapy. Clubhouses are important for where people who have been in hospitals can socialize. And that's what the program is called, Clubhouses. And learn and practice, life skills. People need to have a purpose. And I think with coaching, they can succeed in jobs and school.
Okay. I want to go back to something you said earlier, and you were saying that someone, I guess, maybe the doctors were putting blame on your mother for Rachel's condition. What way were they blaming your mother?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hi there. I'm really excited to tell you about my latest ebook. It's 4 lessons that you can learn from the near-death experience without going through all the trouble of dying to learn them. I've been studying NDEs for several years now. I am completely convinced that not only are they 100% real, but that there's some very universal wisdom that we can get from the near-death experience. And I've distilled that down in this book into 4 short lessons. And I've also given you all the reasons why I believe the NDEs are absolutely real. So go to www.grieftogrowth.com/NDE lessons to pick it up for free. www.grief2growth.com/NDE lessons. I hope you enjoy it.
Oh, excuse me. That goes back to with autism, the idea of the refrigerator mother. That was in the 1960s. It's kind of post-Freudian type of thinking that the mother's responsible for, the development of the child. And if they don't bond, and mothers were blamed, for anything with children in those days, it's not so much these days, but it was back then. I mean, there were issues with my mother, but, children grow up with issues against their parents. But the issues Rachel had caused her to accuse my parents of things, and then the psychiatrist in charge of her case would then believe her literally, instead of having these open, having constructive, non-judgmental conversations. They would be conversations about blame. So whenever you get a family together, kids are going to start blaming their parents, and somebody's going to either support them or not. You need people who are skilled in very non-judgmental family interactions.
Right.
There is an approach now they call it open dialogue, where you have family system, and you bring the whole, and maybe close other people in the network, close in the network. You bring them together and allow them to discuss the issues that might be between parent and child, mother and child, in a way that allows everybody to air their grievances and to be non-judgmental. So I think that's the key. People were just quick to have judgments about mothers in those days. I think it's not as bad now.
Yeah. So I know in your book, you included some of Rachel's poetry and her letters that kind of come through in her own words. So what would you like for us to know about Rachel?
Oh, that she was fiercely intelligent. I talked to people who knew her in Israel, and I said, oh, she was talking about things, you know, politics and art, and she was curious and adventurous. Her thinking was adventurous. And she was a good person. She never knowingly hurt anybody. And she just had a sense of adventure. She had a lot to offer.
Mm-hmm.
And she had a beautiful spirit. And I think the strength of that spirit is what worked for her and against her. She wouldn't give in. I think something didn't make sense. She would, I got, as part of my research, I got notes from, the Oregon State hospital systems that she was in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very hard to go through, but, you know, when they would tell her she would have to, hygiene is a big issue for people with schizophrenia. For some reason, they lose their sense of hygiene. So they were always encouraging, trying to get her to shower more. And a nurse said, I gave her the shampoo, and she said, the soap will do fine. You know, she's just like, let me do it my way.
Mm-hmm.
So she had this sense of herself that might have gotten her in trouble with people in charge of the system, but yet it kept her going, and it kept her through all these really rough times, and she survived the system.
Mm-hmm.
She did survive the system, and that's the story that, you know, I hope people enjoy in the book, is how she survived it. And she was able to meet up with people who meant something to her, who she could connect with, especially in the last decade of her life.
Mm-hmm.
And she had a spiritual side, too, that I wasn't even aware of for quite a while.
Really? Tell me about your spiritual side.
Well, at the end of the book, she found a synagogue, and she, without the help of her caseworker, her social worker, he told me that she would just go there herself. They didn't know. They were shocked at, you know, she looked like a street person. And they were shocked when they saw her saying the prayers. They thought she was just looking for shelter, but then they realized, and they got her to clean herself up a little bit, and they honored her, and had her lead the congregation in prayer. And I only found out about that after she died from somebody who contacted me.
Mm-hmm.
Part of, I think, being a poet, you know, is kind of transcending. There's a transcendence to it, mm-hmm. the identification with nature. She always, that's one of the reasons we thought she might do better in the Pacific Northwest. She loved nature so much, and she loved walking. And to her, that was a very spiritual experience. When she was in Eastern Oregon, in Pendleton, I think she identified with the Native American, the indigenous population there. They were very prominent in that part of the country. She talked to me when I visited her a lot about their beliefs. So she was a seeker.
Yeah. So she passed at the age of 59, was that correct? So
mm-hmm. Correct, yeah.
So she did survive the system, as you said, for several years. Was she in the system when she passed, or were you able to be with her or anything like that?
She was out of the hospital system.
Okay.
This was this marvelous caseworker who got her out. And she was just under the care of this local agency.
Okay.
And they found housing for her. It took a couple tries before they found her the perfect place for her. in the woods and not totally remote because there were other of these little houses in the woods. So they brought her medication that she needed and helped her out as much as she wanted. She could walk, she could take a, you know, hike whenever she felt like it.
Yeah.
And she was there, they would leave her the medication. So she had her freedom, which is what I always just wanted for her. I wanted her to be free. And I just hated the thought of her being confined. Mm-hmm. And she had her freedom. And she was under the care of this agency, but it was not a hospital system.
Okay. Okay. And yeah. So you have your corporate career and you decide, I'm going to write a book about my sister and what this does to my family. So what was the reasoning behind you putting the book out? Why did you decide to make this?
Yeah, that's a big, I think Rachel just influenced me. when she died, I just wanted people to know. I wanted to just write in testament to her, to who she was. And I said, mm-hmm. I felt this urge to tell her story. So, yeah, as you said, I was working corporate, and it took me a long time. I did a little bit of this, a little bit of research. Mm-hmm. Then my mother came to live with me, my family, and I interviewed her a lot, got lots of stories from her. And when I retired from my corporate career, I was able to write more consistently. Mm-hmm. And it came together in bits and pieces and with encouragement from people who I shared my writing with and writing classes. And I wanted to be able to share her poetry too. So I do, as you said, I have 6 poems in the book. And so I braided together my story and my sister's story and my family's story.
Right.
And I just felt that I wanted to honor her. I wanted to solve the mystery to me of why her condition became so bad. And that meant delving into family history, family decisions. And I braided that into the story too. So I had this curiosity about what happened. So writing the book helped me solve it. I got hold of all these letters and I could see certain patterns that I hadn't been aware of before.
So how's your remaining family, how have they reacted to the book being out?
Oh, very well. My siblings were very supportive. Mm-hmm. My mom passed by the time. It would have been a little bit hard to publish it while she was alive because yeah. You know, they were painful parts of her life. And, you know, who needs to, you know, to go through that again when you're mm-hmm. in your 90s? So it was just my 2 siblings left and they were supportive. And help me with the timeline and recall certain things. And then my own children were just really, really very supportive. One of my daughters said, who was born when Rachel first became ill, my first daughter, said, oh, now I understand what I was born into. I was born into the middle of something, you know, when mm-hmm. she read the description of what exactly was happening when she was born. My granddaughter would come in when she was tiny. She's a teenager now. But, you know, when's a book going to be finished? How many pages have you written? You know, mm-hmm. so she would just egg me on. I couldn't stop after that. I mean, it was a matter of I just had to finish it. I had invested so much time and commitment to it. And once you tell it, people you're writing a book, then, you know.
Yeah, once it's out there, people start to ask you, when's it coming out?
Make that commitment.
Well, I'm glad that you're telling Rachel's story and your family's story and you know sharing her legacy. And every time we do something like this, it helps overcome that stigma that we have around mental illness. I think, you know, we were talking about people don't understand it. There's a lot of blame that goes around, a lot of shame that goes around. And the way to overcome that is to expose us to the truth, you know, the good, yeah. the bad, and the not so great. So appreciate you doing that very much.
Yeah. And I hope people will support organizations that support people who need it because of mental illness. Yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, we used to go to, you know, extremes, we just institutionalized people. And then we kind of went to the other extreme and just, you know, everybody's kind of on their own. So hopefully we're finding a more healthy balance now.
Right, right. And if people are failing outside of the institute, it's not, the answer is not to send them back in, but to provide better community support and keep funding those organizations that can provide it, like the one that finally helped Rachel. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, Deborah, thanks so much for being here today. Remind people again of the name of your book and where they can find out more about you.
Roll Back the World, A Sister's Memoir. I have a website, DeborahKasdan.com. And you can find the book online at any of the online bookstores, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, bookstore.org. And I hope people will be touched learning about Rachel, my sister.
Absolutely. I'm sure they will. Well, I'll have the links in the show notes so people can find it. And Deborah, again, thanks for being here. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you, Brian.
Have a great day. Bye. Hey there. If you liked this episode, come on over and talk about it. Let me know what you liked. If you didn't like this episode, come on over and talk about it. Let me know what you didn't like. Go to grieftogrowth.com/community and look for Talk About the Podcast. I'll see you there.